Living Places, How to Challenge the Way We Live and Build. Hi, my name is Marcin Wojciech Żebrowski and welcome to the newest episode of Urbcast, my podcast about urbanism, architecture, cities and many more. And today we will focus on a project that is personally one of my favorite places to go in Copenhagen, and I'm taking many of the guests there, namely the Living Places, which is an initiative led by Velux, the window manufacturer, in collaboration with partners like architects, Effect, and engineering MOE. This project aims to transform the building industry's approach by showcasing a living environment that's both sustainable and regenerative. Through innovative strategies and a focus on indoor climate, energy efficiency, and sustainable materials, Living Places challenges conventional building forms. For those of you who live in Copenhagen or are coming with a visit, we are talking about the wooden village of 7 houses, 2 of them being furnished as family homes that you can visit. Other wooden structures serve as community facilities and are more opened. Come and sit in the central Copenhagen close to Banegården in Jernbanebyen, the old railway area in the very center of the city. And today my guest is Ambra Guglietti, who is an engineer and sustainable building expert at Velux. She works in a team called Buildings of the Future, where they collect the knowledge around sustainable and healthy architecture, in particular about daylight, indoor climate, and energy, and they transform it into value for Velux, for architects working with daylight, for academia, and for institutions joining them in research projects and partnerships. And this project, the Living Places, is an example of such an initiative. We'll discuss the background of the project, the materials used, the reception of the project. It was opened during the World Architecture Festival in Copenhagen in June and in July, and it got a lot of traction and visitors. One of the most important questions here is the question of scalability of such a project, and this is something that Ambra also explains to us. So welcome to the newest episode about Living Places with Ambra. Welcome, Ambra. Thanks for being here in Urbcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm happy that you are here and that you will share something more about the Living Places experiment that is here in Copenhagen. And I think that it is a very successful one. And we've just discussed that you've been surprised yourself how successful it was, how many people it attracted. But before that, maybe you could just say something more about yourself and your journey towards this moment when we are able to talk about the Living Places by Velux.
So I'm Ambra Guglietti, and I work at Velux. I work in a department called Buildings of the Future. It's a very special department because we work with not only our products. As you know, Velux produce roof windows, but we also work with how the products affect the buildings and the indoor climate, sustainability, daylight, of course, and so on. So we have this approach of the buildings, and we look at how the buildings of the future should look like, also to inform our products afterwards.
And how did you personally end up in this project? Because you are the indoor climate specialist, and I think that this is, of course, something that you use in your daily work. But how this experience and expertise you have connects with the project?
Yes, so when I started in Velux 3.5 years ago, more or less, I was an indoor climate specialist in this team that is a knowledge center for exactly indoor climate, daylight, energy, sustainability, and so on. So we acted as the expert from the Velux side, trying to convey the Velux vision, this message of trying to build something that is healthy for people and planet. And this was the role, basically, of the Velux specialist, staying together with the architects and the engineers to actually make sure that the message was there all the time and it was not getting lost in the details of the project.
How many things actually is Velux doing? Because before I've seen the Living Places experiment here in Copenhagen, I was aware of Velux. I heard about the company, especially, of course, because of the windows. But I had no idea that you are only focused on the roof windows. And the second thing is that you are investing in such research projects like this one.
Yes, and that's the amazing part of working at Velux, to be honest. It's a company that is not only focusing on the product itself and doing it good, they chose to just stay on the roof and just do that one. And then there are some sister companies, of course, producing facade windows, doors, and so on. But Velux is focusing only on that specific product and all the accessories around it. And then put other efforts on the research that can help the product being good for people, adding value and bringing some benefits to the people that are living under the roof.
Or I at least already mentioned the Living Places a couple of times in this conversation. And we also discussed that there were and there are still many people visiting this project, this experiment. But for those of the listeners who are not aware of what the project is, could you introduce that?
So Living Places is, as you said, an experiment. So it's an experimental project that Velux started in 2020, more or less, beginning of the year, trying to really think out of the box, think differently than, regular project, we can say. We went out and find some partners that were like-minded and that were sharing the same vision to try and build something healthy for people and planet. So we found effect architects and Artelia engineers, and we started this journey with a very long brainstorming. So if you ask them as well, it was a completely different project than a regular project. And I know myself because I've been working in engineering consultancy before. So I was completely shocked by this process with such a long brainstorming, really allowing ourselves to think, to discuss, to go through different solutions, trying to understand pros and cons of each solution, and then really focus on what are we trying to do here? What is the problem that we are solving? So we went through different challenges that we have, that we see in the world, and that we see in the housing sector especially. Plus, of course, approaching the climate challenge in a different way. So thinking, if we have to build because we need new houses, if we have to, can we do it in a different way? And how do we do that? What kind of questions should we ask ourselves to reach a good result?
So one can say that the end of the project, or maybe that's only the end of some process and a cycle, is that the prototype is now standing, it's built, it's a village consisting of a couple of houses, mostly made of wood. But how do you start such a project? How do you start all this brainstorming? And especially, how do you approach the partners, the collaborators, saying, you know what, we would like to make this experiment, but in a completely different way?
That's exactly what we did. Velux launched a sustainability strategy also in 2020, setting really high ambitions on reducing carbon footprint of our products, of the operations, and so on. But then there was also this target that is a bit special, that is saying, show how to build sustainably in a way, like lead the way, go out, try, see what is possible and inspire others to do the same. And that's what we did. We went out finding partners. Of course, we knew somebody in the industry in Denmark. We started to have conversation. And then when we thought we found the right people, then we actually booked the meeting room and started the conversation. And as you said, that's how we started, with the brainstorming, trying to first have a concept, a way of building differently, a way of thinking the housing sector differently. And then slowly we went to specific project. So we started from a concept and also putting the base with a model that we call the Compass model, with some drivers. It's not rocket science. It's like simple drivers like environment, healthy, affordable, community, local, quality, and so on. So things that all architects think about. But we just put it in writing with some nice visuals and like with some explanation that can help the process and that can help also the thinking.
And did you have an end result that you were wishing for? Because You've also said that you've been quite surprised by the kind of reception of the project, especially that it was a new way of creating a house, different values, different approach. So what was your expectation? Did you have any expectations before?
That's a good question. I don't think we started with some specific expectation. I think a lot came on the way. Especially the prototype was not that we started saying we have to do a prototype. We started thinking, and then on the way came the opportunity to partner up also with the UIA and Copenhagen in Common for one pavilion, and then make different pavilions and have this exhibition for this year in Copenhagen. And the main idea, I think, it was really to try and build a village where people can live. So this experiment is a start, we can say, and we still hope that there will be a village where people live, and then we can get a feedback on how actually those houses are. How is it to live in?
How does living places reduce the CO2 emission and the energy consumption in buildings? In our way, what was done differently that this was possible actually?
I think we go back to the process and the time spent. Normally in a project, you don't spend so much time in thinking through the different materials. And here it was, it's a puzzle, you know. You choose materials that you want to use. So for example, we decided to use wood. We thought it made sense in this context, in the Danish context. And then from that, we started to look at different type of wood, different manufacturers, which one has the lowest CO2 emissions. And the same with all the other materials. And then in the end, you try to find the best solution for each of these components.
And how would you describe it, the whole project, I mean, the physical part of the project, to those of the listeners who couldn't see it themselves? Because for us, it's pretty easy to talk about it for you because you've been involved in this process for so long. And for me, because I've visited Living Places many times, I've been to the opening. I also have met you once there during the World Architecture Congress. So it's pretty easy. And of course, I will add some links to the project in the description. But would you be able to explain in the best way possible to the listeners, how does it actually look like? What's the atmosphere? And yeah, what's the quality?
Yes, I'll try. It's not easy.
It's a challenge since it's a podcast only.
So basically you have those pavilions coming from the street. You can already see those wooden houses. And then when you start walking through, you have a wooden deck with some outdoor areas, with some benches and plants. And there is even a garden where we planted some vegetables and herbs. You can walk around the houses and then, or the pavilions. And then among the pavilions, there are two houses. So those are real houses, also with furnitures, and like they really look like houses. Of course, they're a bit minimal. There is nobody living in there since it's an experiment and we don't have permission to live there.
Although I would volunteer.
I know I did volunteer as well, but we had no permission to do that. But that would have been nice also to collect some data, some feedback, also about the indoor air quality and so on. But yeah, unfortunately, it's not possible. But actually, with all the visits that we had, even though for short time, it can be from 10 to 20 minutes visit, people actually like to stay in the houses. And it's hard also to let them go if you have another group coming in. So it's always hard to send people out. They really feel home, kind of. So the feedback has been really good also for people that were working in the in this wooden deck outside. Of course, it's an experiment, so it's not fully integrated with the surroundings because it's a Jernbanebyen is an industrial area, which is developing now slowly with different experimental projects actually here and there. But of course, also this one has not been thought from the beginning to be in that area. But the feeling that you have arriving and walking around those pavilions is you feel kind of home somehow. And everybody that visited, I have to say that they asked if they could live there, if they can build it, that they really like the environment and the feeling of community that there is among these pavilions. And I always say, I mean, here are like also open pavilions. One look like a greenhouse, another one, or like couple maybe look like greenhouses. Another one is fully open. Then you have those two houses. So imagine if it's actually a village with, I don't know, 15, 20 houses and greenhouse and the garden, and like that is really alive. then the feeling it's even more.
So the two houses are the ones that are made into kind of real houses, air quotes. So the ones that you could potentially live in. And the other ones are the kind of open structures where you can gather, where you had different workshops, lectures, and so on. And I guess that would also serve as some kind of this open community place for people to gather. You've mentioned the indoor air quality and air circulation. Let's discuss that as well, because I think that this is also an important aspect that you emphasize and that you also emphasized during one of the visits, that you made it in a way that the circulation is designed in such a smart way that you could just cool off the house and maybe actually, I guess, warm it up as well, just for the airflow. Could you say something more about this?
So the two houses are made in a different way because we wanted to experiment different solutions. So in one house, we have only natural ventilation. And in the other house, we have hybrid ventilation. So it's a mix of natural and mechanical ventilation. So in the natural ventilation, you'll see when you enter the house, you don't see any mechanical devices. You just see a lot of windows, a lot of opening that you can use to create a flow. And the best part of the flow is the height of the building allows you, of course, using roof windows, allows you to use the stack effect. So the air would come in from the bottom of the house. And then for the density of the air, the warmer air will go up and then will go out from the roof window. So you will have the fresh air coming, staying down. And yeah, being basically the fresh air that you breathe in the house. And then we have an heating system, of course, which is provided by radiators. And we chose radiators specifically because the concept of the house is also that it has to be separated, the structure from the systems, to make it easy for assembly and disassembly, for maintenance. If something happens to the system, you need to be able to change it without ripping up the floor. Imagine if you have floor heating, then you have to, if something goes bad, then you have to rip up the floor and change everything. With radiators, it's much easier. Even though radiators also have their cons, of course. We learned that, of course, if you want to hide them because you don't like how they look, you like the aesthetic, and maybe as architect, you can probably relate to this. Then you try to hide them with some furniture, with something. But then the more you hide them, the less they work efficiently. And then you would use bigger ones to provide heat, enough heat in the house. So there are some, of course, pros and cons, but we wanted to make this experiment with a structure that is really easy to assemble and disassemble. That's also the reason why we don't have glue or anything that makes it difficult to disassemble the house. Also because we have to disassemble them. They're not going to stay there forever. So next year, probably there will be the phase of disassembly where we will also learn what goes well, what goes wrong in that phase. Because, of course, it's something that you don't try every time you build something. Also, if you build for disassembly.
Yeah, you often build with some number in mind that it will last for maybe 50, 60 or more years. But I don't think that yet you think much about how will building be disassembled after the use. And I think that this is an important thing, especially nowadays in the era of transformation of the buildings. This is something that is on the agenda here in Denmark. I guess it is pretty advanced discussion around this. And I think that you contribute as well with that. Also, if we talk about the indoor climate, I would like to ask about the significance of achieving certain goals. I've read that you've been wanting to achieve the class one of indoor climate in living places. Could you tell us what is exactly the class one and how is it accomplished?
Yes, so rating system that was done at DTU by some researchers, which created four different classes to rate indoor climate, going from the air quality, so looking at particles, measuring volatile organic compounds, of course the CO2 levels, then the temperature, the noise, daylight, and so on. And they also use this rating to create a rating system called TAIL. So we use the same values to classify the indoor climate level. But then we also benchmarked it with the Active House, which is a rating system that we use quite a lot in Velux. And we like it because it's very simple to use, and it gives you a good picture of, you can say holistically, of the performance of the building, because it looks at the indoor climate, but also the environmental perspective and the quality of the building itself. So also compared to Active House, we were getting category 1, which is the best category that you can get in Active House. So in the end, we were sure it was a good indoor climate, actually.
How much the immediate surrounding has to say in such a measurement? So basically, was that possible also because of the lack of pollution, or maybe lack of the air pollution around? Or is it rather mostly about the indoor system?
It's mostly on the indoor. You probably have some particles that you need to measure inside that can be affected from the outside. But there is no, as I recall at least, there is no rating of the outdoor air. But in this case, of course, it would be a different story because we don't have the permit to live there due to the environment and the local area.
Because you said that it is placed in the old industrial railway area, the Jernbane being the central part of Copenhagen that is going through this transformation. And I guess there is still some pollution around. So it would be very interesting to see how the building performs in different environment, in different surroundings. Although even now, in this occasion, it performs very well.
Yes, actually, we saw from some measurements, we are still measuring even though nobody's living in there. We're still getting measurements with some sensors. And we could see that it's performing better than we expected, especially the house with the natural ventilation. A lot of people are skeptical about using only natural ventilation because if it's raining or if it's too cold outside, then you wouldn't open the windows. But it's still performing quite good. We are actually surprised of the data. So we can say that even though the different systems, both houses are performing well. And we actually tested before knowing that we were building this prototype. We did measurements based on different locations. So we tested in suburban areas and in urban areas, city centers. So even with different conditions. And we try to find the system that could help have the same performance.
How does Living Places prioritize sustainable materials? And how did you incorporate innovation in its construction?
I think the innovation here is to think simple and to think with everything that is possible to buy. So all the materials that are in Living Places, you can go out and buy them in any store. So there is no crazy innovation as such. I think the innovation is the way of designing and thinking this project. It's really taking time to analyze different materials, different options, and test them also with each other to see if the total amount of material is actually giving you a good result or not. Can you do better? And I think the question that we asked ourselves all the time, also in choosing materials, was what if? What if we use this one instead of the other one? What if we change? What if we change insulation material? What if we change the roof? So this what if was bringing actually us forward all the time. But I say that it's the innovation because normally you don't have all the time in the world in a project and you cannot really allow yourself to ask you what if for a long time.
Yes, that's right. I think that this is a big advantage of having such a prototype that you can really test things. I really love prototypes, especially in the cities, in urban scale as well. What if you close a street for cars, for example, for some time and see what happens and so on. So I think that that's a very, very big benefit. And I think that I remember from one of the visits there at Living Places is that you've also really wanted to focus on the materials, as you've mentioned, that are accessible and that ideally you wouldn't need to ship or transport from other countries, right? Because that's also a big contribution to the CO2. And if you want to build sustainably, I guess in the ideal case, you would just use something that is around.
Ideally, yes.
Ideally.
But of course, when you come to solar panels and some, but even wood, you cannot find it everywhere in the quality and quantity you're looking for. So you have to come to some compromises. We try to avoid the shipping from overseas and have materials that are European as much as possible with the lowest transportation as possible. And it's all about, again, comparing the data of those materials and of the producer. So comparing all the environmental product declarations, finding out how much of CO2 they emit during the production. And sometimes if they produce it with a very low consumption and they're very, let's say, environmental friendly, they can even make up for the transportation compared to other materials that are produced maybe close by, but with less environmental friendly processes.
So that was possible in such a small scale, because still the Living Places is a small scale prototype. But what about the scalability of the Living Places concept? Can it be scaled up? And the background behind this question is that this is something that really, really interests me since the very first visit. It looks, to me at least, very nice aesthetically. And I saw myself living in one of those houses at least for a bit. But as you said, it could be that it is built as a village of a couple of those units. So yes, the scalability.
So the scalability was one of the main point in this project. Also because Velux has been doing demonstration projects for almost 20 years, I think. So it's not the first one that we do. But most of the time, the problem was the scalability, because there were maybe special houses done by one architect that really focused on that house, that family that had to live there. So it was not really scalable as such. So this time we really wanted something that could be scalable, at least in the concept. Then, of course, we know that this prototype or the idea of Living Places as a village is done for Denmark, thinking about the Danish conditions, the Danish culture also, what people want from a house. And in another country, you will probably need to reshape it, redo it with the local conditions, traditions, culture, and so on. So it's not something that you take and build everywhere as it is. And also in terms of material, maybe you don't want to build exactly the same in the south. Maybe you want to change something. You want to optimize the materials in a different way. Also because the climate matters, of course, for the performance of the building. But in terms of how scalable it is, we can say, yes, it's scalable. And that's also why the project is open source. And we are just trying to create some kind of agreement in terms of keeping the same quality and keeping the CO2 very low, because we don't want that people will replicate it with the 15 kilos of CO2 equivalent. But we want to keep the low CO2 as a very important point of the project, and the indoor climate as well. So we really care about this, that it's replicated, but with the same purpose, and not that it changed the purpose. But of course, we believe it can be built in different scales, different small villages. And that was the main idea of this concept. And the idea also started because we were looking at the challenges in the housing sector. And we could see that we still need to build because are missing especially affordable houses, but we don't have a lot of space. So we have to build more dense. We have to go probably out in the suburb to build more. And something that we need to realize is that we need to live in less square meters. We cannot afford a house that is for a family of four of 200 square meters in an 800 square meters plot, like the average Danish house that we use as benchmark. And that was the main idea that brought us to this house that is with two or three floors. It can also be with one. So we have different type of house. And you can also combine those in a village to actually meet different needs for people that can also ideally rotate in the house when their lifetime is bringing different needs. And then the other point was, yes, we have to live in less square meters, but we can also share some of the things we need to maybe not have in our private square meters. So in the very beginning, one of the exercises was to think, what is actually our private space and what can be shared. And I think, like, as a student, we share a lot of things. We are used to share kitchen, living room, washing machine, and so on. And then we grow up, and as a family, you don't want to share anything. And every time I'm saying this, I'm telling this story about the concept and so on, how we thought about it, people just say, no, 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 I don't want to share a washing machine. Or I don't want to share my home office. So it's really interesting to hear, like, as a cultural element, what people is willing to share and what is not willing to share. And then I always think that in some period of your life, you're willing to share and you're willing to have more community feeling. Why not having the same after? So that's really something that we need to probably think about and maybe change. To actually live in less square meters, use less resources, and share more.
I think this is a brilliant thought, and this is something I'm trying to explore with this podcast as well, which is the notion of discomfort in a way. So I'm not saying that we should, like, live on 10 square meters each, but rather how to rethink the resources that we are using and trying to make them a bit smaller or less. But you're right. I think that we are accustomed to comfort, and we want to have more and more of comfort with time. And I do agree that it is tricky for family, for example, to share a lot of things. Although in Denmark or in Sweden, it is still very popular to have those common washing rooms in the basement. For 7 or 8 years that I'm living in Scandinavia, now is the first time I'm having my own washing machine in the apartment. And for the last 7 years, I've been sharing it, and it wasn't such a problem for me. So, but maybe it's only me. I think that this is another topic for a broad discussion about, like, our needs and comfort and so on. I wanted to ask you for some numbers as well. So you said that also this concept is that it is a more affordable one. It also is built with less CO2. Do you maybe have some numbers? So, for example, we can also add it later if you don't have it now on hand. But for example, how much is such a unit of one of those that you could live in, or how much CO2 did you save per square meter, and so on?
We ended up with an LCA that was 3.8 kilos of CO2 per square meter per year. But we also believe that it's not fair to calculate per square meter, because then you would build bigger and go down with your CO2. So that should also be calculated per person. So it's still a good indicator, but we believe that calculating CO2 per person would be more fair, because then if you are just a couple living in 200 square meter, then you have a higher CO2 impact than a family that is living in 80 square meters. So that's something we should work on in the industry, because it makes a lot of difference in how you approach the CO2 reduction and the use of resources. And then in terms of affordability, we actually had some calculation just to compare with the Danish environment at least. And we found that it's possible to build those houses at the same level of social housing in Denmark. So you can actually make them quite affordable.
What were, like, the biggest insights or lessons learned from living places, and especially the ones that you would share with us, I mean designers, architects, but also with developers, so that we are better as industry to adopt those more sustainable practices?
There are many. I think we have a document of 80 something pages that is downloadable on our website. So you can probably all go and download and learn a lot. But some of the learnings, I think, are, something we discussed already, the time. So allowing yourself to think more how you are designing, where are you putting the resources to do what exactly? How are you optimizing the building in the best way possible? And also, how are you choosing the material? Having this extra time to really think about, is this wood better than the other wood that I use in the other project? Really finding, because I think this is the innovation, actually. is not using always the same material because, you know, it's there, it's easy, you have already the EPD downloaded on your PC, but finding other materials that maybe are out there with data, with everything you need, and they are maybe contributing better to your project. So I would highlight that as innovation or learning, because that helped a lot. And probably, I'm sure that if we do it again, we can even reach a lower CO2 footprint, because then you learn a lot on the way and you kind of, yeah, come up with the new ideas. But also moving forward, a lot of manufacturers are pushed to give data and have this transparency on their products. And that helps to figure out which material is better than the other. And that will push the industry even more to do better. So the more architects push manufacturers, I would say the better we go on the CO2 side.
My last question was about the book recommendation, and you already recommended a book. I think that this is important that we emphasize to read those books, to take them in your own hands and read and then implement the things. So what would be your book recommendation besides the one you've mentioned?
So I would say the Donut for Urban Development that came out in June, I think. So it's quite recent. But I think it contains a lot of those things we discussed today. It gives even more, actually, because it gives really a perspective of how to use the donut economy in the building industry and how to approach designing for different purposes, I would say, and also with a different way of thinking. So that would be one.
Good timing. I just downloaded it today, because you can also, you can buy it, but you can also download the PDF. Yes. I just did it today. So perfect timing.
And it's very readable and very nice, very enjoyable. So it's a very good book and a manual, actually. So you can use it. You don't need to learn everything that is in there. You just keep it at hand when you need it. And then the other one, also to compensate, since we always advocate for healthy buildings for people and planet. On the people side, I would say Healthy Buildings from Joseph Allen and John McComber. They are both professors at Harvard. And they wrote this book some years ago, but I think they're also updating the book and releasing new editions. And they're really explaining the concept of why healthy buildings are important, why people should live in healthy buildings, and what kind of benefits is also bringing to society to have healthy buildings. Because living in sick buildings is just making people sick, less productive, less happy. And they give a lot of examples and cases and also numbers to quantify what does it mean for a society to have sick buildings. So that's also a good book to learn something about the healthy buildings and indoor climate.
Thanks for sharing and preparing those. And now the ball is in your court, dear listener, because now it's the time to check those books and ideally read them and then implement the findings in there. Amber, I wanted to say thank you so much for this discussion. I think that it was very refreshing to talk about such a prototype. And luckily, myself, I've been there. I've seen it. But if there's anyone who hasn't seen it yet, what's the deadline for the prototype being around still in Copenhagen?
It's probably end of the year, but maybe be faster, because with winter approaching, it's not the best to go out there.
Yes, everything is worse in Copenhagen with the with the cold, dark winter or fall, actually. But yes, if you have time, if you're around or not in the, at least visit the website. I will add the links into the episode's description. And yeah, of course, reach out to Amber as well, to me as well. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for today's episodes with Ambra. And I hope that we managed to inspire you and to think about how can you reduce your own, living impact on this planet. If you would like to get to know something more, visit the Herbcast website, the Living Places website, or reach out to Ambra, for example, on LinkedIn. I will add all the links in the episode description. Thank you and talk to you soon.